Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week, our attention turns to the finer art of value and growth investment styles and a couple of others. Value investing is the art of buying stocks which trade at a significant discount to their intrinsic value. Value stocks refer to stocks of companies that are considered cheap relative to their long-term earnings and growth potential, usually with a stable business model that focuses on the fundamentals, or in other words, trading lower than their actual fundamental value. This approach requires a contrarian mindset with a long-term investment horizon. It could also be said that value investing typically underperforms through a market cycle, but it is known for its odd patch in the sun, as we've seen recently. Growth stocks refer to companies that are expected to grow faster than the rest of their industry sector or the market as a whole, and have above average long-term revenue and or earning potential. As growing the business is a priority, these companies usually reinvest their earnings to expand quickly, often at the cost of delaying profitability. So how have the two investment styles fared recently? And is there still opportunity as the market rotates from value to growth? Well, in 2020 alone, the MSCI World Growth Index outperformed the MSCI World Value Index by nearly 35%. As we spoke about last week, much of this performance was driven by the US mega cap technology stocks, namely Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Alphabet, and Microsoft. These stocks have been able to deliver real structural earnings growth in a low return world. And so now the question remains, is value investing still relevant in the face of these tech growth behemoths? And what are some other options to consider? So here to share his thoughts on the major styles of investment and how they influence our portfolios, we have our head of investment, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And just a quick reminder that before we get started, if you haven't already, subscribe and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. We also ask if you'd like to take a moment to click like on the video now to help our show grow. And for all those listening in live now, feel free to drop in your questions in the YouTube live stream chat to have them answered along the way. So let's jump into the agenda for today. So we're going to be looking at, with a quant recap, what's working at the moment. We'll then be looking at some different themes and styles of investments. So low volatility, momentum, growth, quality, value, and then, of course, wrapping up as we do with our own investment outlook and how we use perhaps some of these styles and how they influence the investment here at Nucleus Wealth. So let's kick off, Damien. Big show.
Yeah, it's been and the part of the reason for this is we've had some quite extraordinary volatility between different styles. And what you typically see is that once styles are sort of in for so to speak, they often last for months or years in terms of that style sort of being the theme for the market. But what's been quite different about the market at the moment is a lot of chopping and changing between styles.
Right.
And so, we really wanted to talk about that, especially this year so far, it's sort of been, 1 month, one style's turn, the next month, the next style's turn, and just back and forth. And so, I just want to really to explore what's going on and then talk about, what does that actually mean for investors and what you should be looking at.
Yeah, sure. All right. No, look, I think we'll have plenty to chat about.
Yeah, so let's start by sort of talking about what are styles, what do we mean by when we start talking about investment styles? And so the idea is that these are all sort of mathematical models that have been generated to help look at performance. So it's a matter of trying to look at companies and work out, are you looking at a company that's more interest rate sensitive? And so therefore, as interest rates fall, that stock's likely to rise and perhaps have quite stable earnings.
Yep.
Or are we talking about the growth companies or cyclical companies? So as the economy comes out of recessions and into this sort of growth phase, you'll see value stocks will perform at that point. Later on in the cycle, you'll get the growth stocks and the quality stocks outperforming. And so, and when you get downturns, that's where quite often the growth stocks will be the ones that are the hardest hit.
Yep.
And so, that's what they're talking about. They don't like their styles don't always work, but a lot of these quant signals, you know, they work more than they work more often than they don't, mm-hmm. which is why people sort of follow them as an investment.
Sure.
And there's also this idea that there's sort of an implicit assumption that's being made about reversion or non-reversion. But that sort of leads to my, before I get into that, sort of lead to my most important question is, are you selling insurance to the rest of the market? Like that's, whenever you're looking at any different style of investment, that's the very first question you should be asking, because there are strategies out there that are basically providing liquidity to other players. And it's this idea of picking pennies up in front of a steamroller, as they call it, where mm-hmm. there's a strategy. And actually, I'll use something that's probably more similar to that most people would be able to understand is home insurance. So, I might decide tomorrow that I'm going to open up a home insurer, and I go and I get and I'm going to insure everyone's houses against fire and earthquakes and whatever it is. And I go and I get home insurance from you, Tim, and then I get home insurance from somebody else and somebody else, and I end up with sixty different people all giving me $100 a month in home insurance. And I'm like, well, how good is this business? I get $6,000 every month. Exactly. And then there's a major earthquake or something happens and hailstorms and people's roofs all get damaged or whatever it is, but it all happens in the same area, and all of a sudden I've got this massive payout. But every month it felt really good because I was getting like, hey, look at these insurance premiums coming in. What a great way to earn money this is. And there are trading strategies out there that are like that. And basically there's people saying they don't want to take the risk that there's a sudden reversal and a sudden problem.
Yep.
I can just see this. The sun has moved in to give me a bit of a halo effect.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Let me just drop a curtain as well. That's a actually I'm a bit further. Sorry. Sorry about that.
Nothing like live shows to show up.
That's right.
Anyway, keep going.
Exactly. So the idea is that there are trading strategies that give you the same liquidity issues, and often people might be doing that unknowingly. So other people are saying, well, I don't want to take this bet because I'm worried that there are days in the year where everything reverses, or there's an options expiry, or there's some other sort of event that happens, or stocks coming in and out of MSCI indexes, or other things like that mean that this is a strategy that will make a little bit of money very frequently, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden lose 20 times, 100 times more than what it ever made in a very short period of time. And so that's that, with any strategy, you really just need to keep coming back to that question if you have a sort of mathematical model for how you're going to make money.
Sure. Yep.
So then that leads on to the five main strategies I'm going to talk about. There are other ones that people do, but these tend to be the most frequently used strategies that quant analysts look at.
Yep.
Is momentum. So basically, if your stocks that are going up will keep going up, and stocks that are going down will keep going down. I'll get into more detail on each of these in a little bit. Low volatility, which is a sort of curious outcome that from most people who've done economics or finance at university would have learnt this whole trade-off between risk and return that you have. So the more risk you take, the higher your return.
Yep.
And there's a sort of famously the efficient frontier, and it's this idea that you can map between if I'm buying a high-risk stock, that then I will get a higher return over the longer term. And if I'm buying a lower risk stock, then I'll get a lower return over the longer term. And for the last sort of 30 odd years, I think maybe you might even get a longer period where basically if you just bought low volatility stocks, you would have beat the rest of the market. So you're finding the stocks that with the in theory or in a particularly defined definition of what risk is. It's basically the opposite to what economic theory is saying.
Yeah, right.
And so, that's another one. Growth is basically looking for stocks that are going to grow faster than the rest of the market and buy those ones. Quality is a matter of trying to find stocks that have high margins, earnings that don't vary that much, I guess, a number of measures of solid businesses that will withstand, you know, various cycles and get good returns on the equity they're investing.
Is it corporate governance ever factor into that sort of side of things, or?
It does for us. Yep. For the official indexes, it doesn't. But okay. Most people who invest sort of fundamentally will think about those types of things when it comes down to quality is to what they're doing.
Okay. Sure.
And then the last one is the mean reversion part. It's the value ones where you buy cheaper stocks, and in theory they'll rise because they'll come up. But I guess the why I've highlighted that one in red is that every single one of the other strategies relies on the fact that whatever's happening is going to keep happening, whereas the value strategy is actually saying, well, these stocks are cheap at the moment, but they won't be cheap in the future.
Yep.
And okay. So that's the So it is quite a different strategy to other ones. And within each of those, and I guess what I'm highlighting it is because for each of them, whichever strategy you've decided that's yours and you're going to follow, is that you need to know when stocks are falling out of that strategy, because that's the most important part of
when
it.
You so sell.
I'm buying a growth stock. Everything I need to be looking at is when is this stock going X growth? Because once it goes X growth, it's now no longer my criteria.
Sure.
Quality stocks, I'm buying quality stocks, but I need to keep watching. When is the quality of this stock deteriorating and earnings getting more volatile and those types of things? And then, whereas value is exactly the opposite, is saying, well, what's going to change? What's the fact that it's actually going to change it so it will actually mean revert?
Yeah. So I guess just on that though, because as you say, like you're buying it because it's cheap on its fundamentals, I suppose price earnings is a really basic measure as well, perhaps for some people who wanted to buy value, I'm assuming. You've got obviously getting out would probably be fairly easy with a value style because you go, okay, well, I've bought it when it's cheap, it's now fairly valued, and now it's time to get out. But getting in is probably the hard bit with value, isn't it? You've got to try and work out when you can get in, if you're ever going to get in.
I don't know. It's easy to talk yourself into buying value stocks because they are cheap. That's by definition. You're looking at stocks and you're saying, okay, well, on this measure, I can look at this stock and it's cheap on this measure. The issue for me is that everything's got to have another axis on the value side. Is saying buying, I'm an adherent to the belief that there's no such thing as a bad company. Yep. It's just a bad price for a company. So, if there's a company that's it's going to fall over. It's going to, it's over the next 5 years, it's going to go out of business, but it's making $100 this year and then $80 and then $60, down to zero over 5 years. And that's it. The company's gone.
Yep.
You're saying, okay, well, if that's what it's making, and I'm paying $10,000 for that company, is saying, well, that's not worth it.
Yeah.
Okay. But if I can buy it for, today's earnings, this year's earnings, I'm saying, okay, I can buy it for $100. Well, I'm getting my money back in a year. And then anything else on that's gravy.
Mm.
So it is that question about, what's on the other axis. I tend to say you either need to be looking at either growth or quality. So if you're buying a company that's really cheap, but it's shrinking every year, then you probably need to work out how much is it shrinking.
It's not a growth company and it's probably poor quality.
Yeah, that's right. And so typically what you'll see is the types of companies you do often get in those value screens are things like banks or energy stocks,
right?
And energy stocks are there because they do have these really high capital returns. They're not at all in control of the price. They have to accept whatever price is out there.
Yep.
And they're often got to make investments, decades before they're going to make money out of it.
Yeah,
exactly. Sure. So you invest today, you invested 5 years ago and the share and the oil price was $100, and then you turn around and by the time your project's coming on, it's now $50. And so the question about saying is how much do you want to pay for those companies versus other ones. So so there's an element there which you need to then come to the assessment of, okay, is it the way most quant investors will try and look at things is do some what's called sector neutralization or looking at least factoring that into saying, okay, well, let's have a look at this stock versus its own history or versus its sector or versus stocks of a similar like, and then say, okay, well, for us, for example, a stock is good value if it's cheap versus the market, yeah. Cheap versus its industry, and cheap versus its own history as well. And so then you can sort of say, okay, well now I've got saying, yes, this thing does look like it's good value on a number of different measures. And then the next step is saying, okay, well, now let's have a look at the quality side of it. And where does the quality sit? And sometimes we'll just go, well, you know, regardless of that, if it's really, really low quality earnings, then we're not going to invest anyway. But if you can sort of go, well, it's average quality earnings and really, really cheap, it's mm-hmm. like, there we go. Well, that's a tick for us to in terms of what we're interested in buying.
Okay. Yeah, no worries. Very good. Thanks for that. Return disaggregation.
Disaggregation. Yeah. So what I just wanted to highlight as well, whenever you're looking at quantitative strategies, you know, there's this idea that what we're doing is trying to split the return into its component parts about saying, okay, we've got a stock that's up 10% over the last year. How much of that is because its earnings have improved? How much of that is because its valuation, the multiple people are prepared to pay has gone up? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's the other way around. You know, earnings, the stock's gone up 10%, earnings have gone up 20%. And so the multiple people are prepared to pay has actually come down. Yep. So it's cheaper. And so it's about trying to break those, break the categories in and try and work out what's really driving it. The big issue though you have is this idea of overfitting is that, machines are getting more and more powerful. It's much easier now to, you know, for the average quant analyst to dial up 100 Amazon servers and go and run, you know, millions or trillions of permutations and combinations of different strategies, and then come back and say, hey, here's a strategy that works, you know, 99.9% of the time, and it's, you know, whatever it is, and all you've done really is just fit it back to your history.
The perfect model for the past.
Exactly. So you get a time machine, fantastic. Yeah. Go and invest in that. But you know, there's a lot of those is the idea that, you know, okay, I've worked out, you know, that if I bought stocks starting with the letter B every second Tuesday, as long as it wasn't a prime number, then I'm going to make, you know, I would have made all this money over that. And then you're like, well, yes, you've just gone back and basically sorted through this data to happen to find a random pattern that you can manage to map back. And so, you know, that's we spent a long time sort of looking through those overfitting issues. The idea of the self-serving bias is, you know, a lot of these quant ones will sort of go, well, yeah, I know this strategy didn't work for, you know, the 2008 crash and this other crash and these other special events, but they were special events. And so, except for that, this model works great.
Yep.
And it's the idea of saying, that might be fine, but as long as you're expecting that the future is going to look there's never going to be another unexpected event or another strange event like a pandemic or something like that that just comes completely out of left field, then I guess what I sort of my big thing with these is use it very much. We tend to use these very much as a model for how things are going to happen. Mm-hmm. But it's not a religion, and it's not something you have to follow exactly. You know, there will be times where your model will be telling you to do one thing and you'll decide to do the opposite because there is a global pandemic, you know, yep. converging, or governments have just decided to throw all this extra money. And so you can sort of, you know, change your views.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Some of the sectors, resources, utilities, financials, a lot of these don't tend to work very well because they just have different financials, and different ways of reporting and different drivers to other stocks. And, the other thing I'd note is that, you know, if you're running a quant strategy there's lots of different things like manufacturing versus services that can just change your, change the meaning of everything you're doing. So you might find I've seen sort of people come up with, these great quant strategies for looking at value or looking at quality. And all they've unearthed is the fact that, they've used particular ratios where service companies, for example, look better than manufacturing companies. And then, so in periods where services have been growing and increasing and manufacturers have been shrinking, these stocks, you know, they've found a strategy that does really well. But the idea is that, well, if that's your only benefit, really, is you built something that biases towards building services companies or biases towards buying internet companies, yep. then you don't want to sort of nail your future performance to this one thing about saying services will forever outperform manufacturing, or internet companies will forever outperform every other company.
Yeah, because, doesn't sound very dynamic, does it?
So it's about saying, well, what is my model? Making sure your model is actually, as much as you can, a sort of dispassionate observer and trying to look for the right factors rather than just trying to dig in. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but with that, I've probably gone way too long on that type of stuff, because I really want to dig into some of the what's been going on in this recent times. So I've got a chart up of this year's performance. So if we can pop that one up. What we can see on that one is that this is just a month to month. I've used the S&P 500, so the US, just for simplicity.
Yep.
But you get similar trends if you look around elsewhere. And what it's doing is basically saying, if I just took one of these factors and I bought the best 20%, the stocks in the top 20%, and then I short sold the stocks in the bottom 20%, what type of return would have I got from doing that strategy? It's a pretty typical one. Often you might hear it as Q1 versus a Q5, like the quintile one versus quintile five.
And
it's really just an illustration of seeing how the what's sort of driving it. And so you can see that earnings quality factor that's right at the top there for this month. And if you sort of follow that back, you get that earnings quality, you get the historical growth, capital efficiency, and analyst expectations. So those four are what you would typically call either quality or growth metrics.
Yep.
And they're sort of all up this month. They were all up in April. They all had a terrible February.
Mm.
They had a pretty decent January, but it's been very much that 1 month on, 1 month off factor going back and forth. And then at the other end, your value measures right at the bottom there have been the opposite. So it's been their turn. It wasn't their turn this month. They had a shocker this month, mm-hmm. but it was their turn in May. Wasn't their turn in April, and back in March it was their turn. And so
this is what you were saying before about how there's obviously this rotation, as they call it, between the various things. But at the moment, it seems to be a lot faster than it has been in the past.
Yeah, and keep in mind, this is just the ones I'm showing here. This is just your monthly, which is effectively a randomly chosen day at the end of at the start and end of the month.
Right.
If you took it from peak to trough, within each month, I don't know if you could quite double all those, but you could certainly add another 50% to the to the top to bottom in most of those. So it's been extreme, and so every month you go, yeah, we had value, we had a great one, or quality. So it's been each person's turn from month to month.
Yeah.
And so there is that big question, which we'll look at later on, which is, okay, what's going to work going forward, and given the volatility, where does it lead?
So just before we just sort of dive into looking forward, like month to month swings like this is pretty highly active, isn't it? So like it shows that there's a lot of I guess either active or there's got to be. Well, let's go the other way. What are your thoughts in why there's this enormous amount of activity where you would assume ETF based sort of thing? It's always quite steady, and there seems to be a huge amount of funds flow, isn't there? Really between the different styles. Is that human driven?
So let's say most of last year, earnings quality was what was driving it. And value was the other sort of end of that trade, and so but it was pretty consistent, month by month. You'd sort of get most of the time the quality would perform. So and that's typical. Yeah, as I was saying before, you usually have quite long trends of where this is time for quality stocks, or this is a time for momentum stocks or value stocks. It's the macro uncertainty that's sort of driving it, and a lot of the inflation side in particular. So there's been a lot of debate on our show as well. Obviously, we've been talking a lot about will inflation come up, or will it be inflation, or will it be transitory, or will it go on?
Mm-hmm.
And so as the market's sort of been battling with those, that's probably the biggest factor that's sort of been driving this. Having said that, the bond market has been a lot more stable.
Mm-hmm.
in terms of its market. So I don't think it's ever really priced in the idea that hyperinflation was going to take off. I don't think it has. It hasn't. It definitely hasn't priced in massive future inflation.
Sure.
Whereas stocks have been a bit more volatile on a month to month as to where they have.
Okay.
So that's your shorter term ones. I'll jump into some of the longer term ones because it's worth noting as well that this is just the same chart but just done on an annual basis for the last 10 years. So it's worth noting value is the key one I'd sort of draw your attention to. So it's sort of third one down on that list. It's had a pretty bad 10 years. very bad 10 years. Now, some of that is the specification, but it's not what you would typically expect to see from a strategy, which is, I'm trying to buy cheap stocks because I'm expecting they're going to go up. Mm. And so, it's had such a bad 10 years that now the question is there structurally something wrong with the value?
Okay.
Or is this just a matter of saying, it's reached such an extreme that now's the time. And value is now going to be the driver for the next 10 years. And so you really need some in your portfolio.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
So I had a chart actually. I forgot to put it in this presentation. But if you can imagine, you've got two sort of two price lines going up, and they're both going up, but they're out of sync with each other. So you sort of one of them outperforms and then underperforms and then outperforms again, and then the next one does the same thing. And so as they cross over, they're both on this line that's going up at whatever 8% per annum.
Yep.
But 1 year one does 15, and the next year it does 5, and then the next year and the other one does the opposite.
Yeah. Okay.
And so they keep crossing over, and so the idea is if you have that pattern and you look at a strategy and say, when it's just reached its peak, so it's just had its great run. Mm-hmm. If you look at that, you're going to be looking back saying, this is the best strategy ever. Over the last 5 years, it's outperformed. Over the last 10 years, it's outperformed. Over the last 50 years, it's outperformed, because it's at a peak.
Yep.
And so, whereas here's this other strategy, always underneath because it's at the bottom.
Yep.
And then they both cross over the next few years where, that has its 15% and its 5%. And now the opposite's true. And you're going to the second strategy saying, oh, no, I was wrong 2 years ago. This is now the greatest strategy ever. Look, over 50 years, it's outperformed or whatever.
Okay.
And so, I guess what I'm trying to get to is you want to look at these with a sort of open mind as to saying, okay, well, as long as I'm looking for a factor that I think is the right factor, then I am interested in its longer term outperformance, but in particular value. I'm interested now, has it been misspecified? And I'll come into that in a minute, because I do think it has. I think there's the way value is being defined has changed, not because the definition has changed, but the underlying accounting has changed and people haven't caught up with it.
Yep.
And then if that's the case, then if I use a different valuation, different technique, would I get a different answers and where it would come from?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. So let's look at some of the winners first. Some of the interesting ones. So I'll start with I'll start with minimum volatility. So because that was sort of at the peak of that so far for this year. So you can see from this line, this is our the blue line on this next chart is the is the line that sort of shows the minimum volatility, and the other one shows
the market,
what the market's done.
Yep.
And so, and then you got sort of the year to year. This is all just so the minimum volatility had this cracking run for from 2010 all the way up to 2020,
mm-hmm.
where it was this great performer, but its performance hasn't been as good since then, and started to come good this year. But this year it's outperformed a little bit, but certainly. That has underperformed for this year as well. Sorry, across the world. Yeah. So this is a question about is there a changing of the guard in terms of this strategy or not? And it had a particularly bad 2020.
Yeah.
So
is that just on the basis that it's probably not holding a lot of those brassier growth stocks, or? Is it not holding as much tech, which was obviously the standout, as we mentioned earlier?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of it's been the growth, not having as much growth. I guess I've sort of titled this next slide that, you know, about the is a tail wagging the dog. So, so my issue with minimum volatility is you go out there and you say, okay, I'm going to buy these stocks that going to find the stocks that have got the least volatility in it, and I'm going to buy those stocks. And they tend to be things like real estate trusts. They tend to be things like utilities. You know, the slow, steady
type companies. Certified income sort of thing. Sort of, very controlled income.
And there is a bit of stuff in minimum volatility in terms of trying to put a portfolio together so that it actually, you're looking for stocks that aren't correlated as well, so that you can bring your volatility down as well. There's a little bit of that special sauce, so to speak, in terms of looking at correlations and stuff like that. But the issue for me is we've been in this period where interest rates have been falling right throughout that time period. And that tends to mean those types of stocks outperform. There's been a lot more interest in this. This has turned into a bit of a flavor of the month over the last, certainly over the last 10 years, probably 15. Like there wasn't a lot of talk about this. It wasn't a major strategy 20, 30 years ago. Because the conventional wisdom was that no, that won't work. You need to buy high volatility stocks because buy high volatility stocks. Yeah, it's a risk return trade off. I buy high volatility stocks, I get a better return.
And I'm a stockbroker, and I live on trading.
Well, that's right. There's a lot more to talk about as well. It's much better.
I'm going to say there's something that you don't need to sell later on. I'll just talk myself out of a deal.
and these often are the boring stocks. You know, it's like, okay, they were delivering electricity yesterday, and guess what? They're still delivering electricity today, and guess what they'll be doing tomorrow? Whereas if you can sort of come out and, you know, this company's acquiring that one and they've just got a new product and all this stuff like this, where it's like, no, they have the same product they have yesterday, electricity. it's not an exciting, it's a less exciting story to talk about. So there's a few things though to keep in mind with this as well, is that there's nothing about the valuation of these stocks in here. So because it's become an exciting story, these stocks, you know, you used to be able to buy them quite cheaply. And because there's much more interest in it, and you've got funds popping up that target this minimum volatility and ETFs, what's happened is, from my part, the valuation of these things has shot up. Interest rates have also been falling. So that's been giving you a good tailwind. And so what that means is that you've ended up with this, the portfolio that's just been overpriced. And so I love minimum volatility. I would definitely, you know, if as I look through the stocks we have, it's one of our quality factors, and it's something we say, yes, if we can find a stock with low volatility, then we'll definitely buy that over the one with high volatility. But the issue also goes back to how much am I paying for this, and how much quality is actually in that stock. If the only thing you look at is the volatility, then you're not capturing all of the story. The other thing is the volatilities of the share price, and the share price is a second order effect. So I've got this company, there's this real company that's either it's got earnings or cash flows, and they're either going up or down or growing or shrinking or whatever they're doing. That's what's really behind this, and that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for low volatility of earnings and cash flows, and a company that's going to grow steadily, or even if it's going sideways steadily, but pumping out high dividends and things like that. You're happy to buy those because you've got a lot more certainty in it. That's not always captured in the share price. So the share price might be reflecting something different. It might be reflecting, say that a company used to have lots of gearing, and so it was quite volatile at the share price, but you know, it sold all that down, and now it's not very geared. So if I look back over 5 years, I'm looking at this company that was geared 4 years ago, but is no longer the case. Or I'm looking at earnings where they might have sold a division that was causing all the volatility in this, and so or vice versa, they might have sold a division that was helping keeping all their earnings stable, and now the company is different. So I guess that's what I'm where I've put that headline is love minimum volatility, but you need to make sure you're not just the tail's not wagging the dog on that. So I sort of treat that as a strategy which you shouldn't be chasing for in its own right. And if you are, be very careful of interest rates, I guess, is the most important one, because that's probably your biggest bet you're actually taking.
So rising interest rates obviously hurting the utilities, because it starts crowding them out of their low or their reliable income sort of desirability.
Yep, and the other thing you would have been caught on in that is owning a lot of, say, real estate trusts, which then had a pretty bad pandemic. And the other thing with that is if you're owning the underlying stocks, it can be a little bit of a volatile strategy as well. That you want to be on top of, because there are a lot of people following these minimum volatility strategies. What often will happen is you'll have a stock that is low volatility, and let's say they do something pretty good, and all of a sudden the stock jumps 20 or 30%. Yeah. And so it jumps 20 or 30%, and which is great. Obviously, I've made some more money from it. But the issue is that might actually be enough of a price movement to start to increase the volatility of the stock, which then kicks it out of a lot of these indexes. And you get all this this index selling coming from, it's like, yes, stock's up 20%, but now we're going to push it back down, 10, 15%, because all the minimum volatility guys are all getting out of it. So you can get some weird trading sometimes from around those ones that's worth knowing if you're running one of those portfolios.
Cool. All right. Very good.
Momentum.
Let's go into momentum.
Yeah, so that's so you, yeah. So you got this line on that. You can sort of see that the line's smashed it in terms of it's been over the last 10 years has been a fantastic performer. And the summary of this one is you buy what's going up and you sell whatever's going down. Hmm. You do get some and this is a strategy that works across asset classes and across a whole bunch of things. It's a strategy that gets used in crypto, gets used in oil, commodities. There's a lot of people out there following these strategies. So they're a little bit self-fulfilling in that people are out there buying stuff that's going up, and so therefore it keeps going up
it's an interesting question actually, just on that one as well though. So when obviously in theory it's easy to see. Okay, so you've got some sort of an algorithm or a trading platform or some sort of automated thing, whatever it is. That then increase, price goes up, it goes, okay, I'll buy a bit more. At some point though, someone's got to pull the handbrake up on that though, don't they? Or is it?
They do. And the idea of these is you've got to be quick. Yeah. So you're going to trade a lot. You're going to be sitting there going, yep. I'm in this stock. Oh, it's turned. Okay. I'm out.
Yeah. Right.
And so you can see this year so far, it's been one of the worst performers of the strategies. Yep. So it's sort of underperformed the market by about 5%. Because of what we're talking about before, that flipping around from ones, it's quality stocks that's going, no, it's not, it's value stocks. No, it's quality stocks. No, it's growth stocks.
Yep.
That's no good for a momentum trader.
Yeah.
Because you just, by the time you're in the stock, it's already reversed and headed back the other way. And then you're flipping out in and out of those. Yep. So that hasn't been good so far. That what they like is nice steady markets where you can rely on that same factor sort of over a longer period of time.
Yep.
So 2020 was a good example of they smashed it, 12% better performance than the MSCI World. Wow. Because basically the stocks that started going up at the bottom of the pandemic kept going up for the next 8-9 months.
Yep.
And so by just following those stocks, whatever's gone up by more of it, drove you to some great performance in that year. But then you do have some pretty bad reversals in this strategy every now and again. That's its main issue is make a lot of money most of the time, and then every now and again you have some pretty bad reversals. And actually the last 10 years have been you haven't really had to worry about that much. But in prior years, that's been outside this sample, there's been some pretty shocking years from momentum.
Okay. Cool.
Some of the other things you need to note, so it is a high turnover strategy. That's these strategies haven't got trading costs in there, and so you don't see that, although you don't see that within those indices. These indices are all just saying, well, forget trading, and it doesn't matter if the values thing turns over 5% of its stocks, and the trading strategy, the momentum strategy turns over 200% of its stocks. Yeah. It just thinks there's no cost to it. And the other thing is
that's that, like, that's like the old science things where they say, oh, you ignore our air resistance, you know? Like...
yeah, exactly. And the other big one for a lot of people is tax as well. So, you know, if you've got a strategy that's turning over 100, 200% of your portfolio every year, then you're not getting the benefit of those capital gains. So, you know, so if I can get a, if I can buy a stock and over the next 5 years it doubles, then, and I'm not selling that stock, then at the end of that, you know, I've started with $100, I've got $200 at the end. If I'm in this high turnover strategy, might have also started with $100 and ended up with $200. But if it started with 100 and then went to 110, then sold it, bought another stock, which then went to 150, and then sold it and bought another stock, all the way along the lines, I've had to pay tax.
Yep.
And so, and usually you wouldn't have got your 12 month, well, almost never would you have got the 12 month CGT benefit for that discount. So, yes, you've ended up making an extra $100, but you might have ended up paying 49% tax. And you know, you started with $100, you've actually only got 150 by the end of it. Whereas, you know, the person who bought and hold in a different scenario, might've ended up, you know, significantly better ahead.
Yep. That makes sense.
What was the other thing? And the other thing is thinking about what it's telling you as well. So like I'll watch these momentum strategies because, I like to see where there's, you know, it's showing there's a bit of smoke and where there's fire. So, and some performance. So some of them are quite reasonable in terms of how it looks. So, you know, Apple releases a new iPhone and sales on day one are pretty good. And so everyone goes and starts upgrading their numbers. And so the stock goes up a bit. And then sales on day 10 are still pretty good. And so therefore people, you know, upgrade their numbers and then on day 20 and day 30. And so it's that part where it doesn't get fully priced in on day one because people are like, okay, well, maybe it was just a, you know, the real fanboys buying it. Maybe it's not going to spread more widely. And then it's seeing as more and more evidence comes in, then the share price can rise more and more. And that's basically what the traders, you know, what those momentum strategies doing is effectively, you know, following that.
Yep.
And and that's why it works. So, and because other people are following it. So, but you know, there's that whole idea that
sounds like groupthink in a dangerous environment to me, but anyway, I guess.
Yeah.
It can work in the right conditions.
Yeah, that's right. And I think in a way you're basically acknowledging that say you're picking restaurants and your only criteria is if this restaurant looks really busy, then I'll go in it.
Yep.
Is it quite often, you know, that's a good way. But sometimes you miss out on the, you know, you might miss out on the newer ones or you might miss out on or you might end up with the one that's actually got a, you know, some major health problems or whatever it is because you haven't done any other research on it.
Yep.
All you've done is said, you know, or it's food you don't like, but all you've done is said, you know, I'm just going to go into the one that has the most people.
Yep.
So, well, but
these days with the pandemic problems, you almost don't want to go to the busy restaurants.
That's right.
We'll be staring down another lockdown if we get too many people in the same room. But anyway, keep going.
Yeah. So let's go. Next, we'll just have a quick look at value. So you've basically got the opposite chart. So value has been over the last 10 years has been the
Barry Crocker.
Absolutely. it's a bit of a revival this year, but you know you're up. Say over the last 3 months or year to date, you're up. You've beaten the market by about 5%, but you're a long, long, long way behind. That's a bit of a comfort, but it's got its issues.
What's the deal though with it? So how's it? Yeah. So where does value differ in your mind?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. First of all, I just want to say that, look, the MSCI, this is all based on what's called the MSCI, which is a provider of indexes.
Yep.
And that's what most people use for these ones as a benchmark. The value that they provide is not what I think value is, and you need to have a look at how they're calculating it. If you're just going to say, yeah, I'll buy the MSCI value index, or I'll buy a manager that's basically trying to benchmark themselves to that and so trying to pick from stocks that are in the value index. So there's this huge reliance on book value. Now, book value has changed over time. Yeah. It's a number that is 30, 40 years ago meant something quite different to what it means today. companies could write up and write down. Over the last sort of 15, 20 years, there's been lots of changes to the way companies have to report a book value.
Yep.
And there's this overall bias that companies want to write, are predisposed to writing book value down with no real mechanism to write it back up again. Whereas what used to happen before was companies would, it'd go up and it'd go down in value. And well, most of the time, you know,
I thought we were going to roll into it, but just the basic 101 on book value as well, just for those wondering, we keep saying it, just in case.
So book value is what accountants measure a company's worth at if they sold all their assets.
Yep.
So it's their assets minus their liabilities.
Okay.
And so the issue is, if you're writing your assets down because now there's a lot more stringent tests on it,
mm-hmm.
and you say, okay, a pandemic happens. All of a sudden, the new factory I built, you know, I just spent $1 billion building this new factory and can't sell anything for whatever reason. So I have to write that down from $1 billion back to 500 million, for mm-hmm. example. So I've written that down, and now my book value is much lower. Then next year, actually, you know what? Pandemic's over. It all bounced back. I've got it all back. Like my earnings are, you know, so, but, The ability to write it back is basically not there.
So you're not allowed to actually, put it, so, value it up, essentially.
Yeah. So it's basically it's been written down. That's it. That's the way it's staying in my balance sheet.
Hmm.
And so so if you're looking for companies that are undervalued because they just spent $1 billion building a factory and the factory is still worth something, but
on the books, you know, doesn't.
you used to be able to use that to go, okay, price has been smashed, whatever, but I think it's still that factory is still worth it, and it's going to come back. Whereas now you're like, well, no, it's sitting on the balance sheet at 500 million, and so that stock might even look expensive, because people who are doing the work are actually looking at it saying, yeah, okay, this thing's worth, you know, they've just built a factory for $1 billion, it's still worth it, you know, I'll pay $1 billion for this. Whereas mm-hmm. whereas you might be looking at the book value going, well, they've only got, you know, by my measure, it's only worth 500 million, so this thing's well way overvalued.
Yeah, sure.
And so yeah.
Okay.
So that's one thing. There's no cash flow measures that MSCI use. There's issues with different accounting standards. You've got this whole issue of forward earnings and really looking at it. And so I've got a chart up on one of these next slides, just sort of showing what the differences are in terms of the in terms of value if you break it down. And so one of the line I want to sort of highlight there is the second one, which is the free cash flow to price.
Yep.
So that's actually been pretty good. So yeah. if you've been following value strategies that flow based,
yep.
yeah, then you've done all right.
Okay.
If you've been following the top one, which is the book value, just saying, yeah, I'm just going to run everything off book value, which is a major factor in the MSCI one and a lot of quant strategies,
yep.
that will run off that, then, you know, last year you were down 30% in 2020, whereas the cash flow one, you were down 2%.
Wow.
So, you get some, I guess what, for me, just one more thing to say that I think it's misspecified to what value is. So you want to be pretty careful about what you're defining as value.
And that's a sort of, that's a common problem across all the major value indices, is it? It's not just obviously an MSCI thing. They're just sort of they're all using the same broken rule book.
Yeah, so there's a Farmer and French are very famous researchers,
mm-hmm.
and book to price is one of their key investing anomalies.
Yeah,
and
right.
so that was the one they identified, and so that's been there's a lot of adherence to that whole you need to buy things that are cheap, and that comes from some of the Ben Graham and Warren Buffettism type things, so
yep.
that. They're looking for stocks trading at a fundamental discount to their assets. But the thing is, they're not those guys are detailed investors.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but they're also detailed investors. Well, Ben Graham's dead, but I've got no doubt that he would not stick to saying, "Oh no, the accounting standards, the official accounting standard says this," and so that's what I'm going to plug into my model, and I'm not going to even look at what the actual assets are or what their cash flows are or those things.
Sure.
Like the whole idea of that was fundamental investing is, we want to know what the company is, what it does, how much its assets are really worth, and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can see that fundamentally, its assets are on its balance sheet at 500, but they should be on at the billion, then you certainly wouldn't be basing your investment analysis off the 500 million.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
So yeah, so super. So that's my big thing for value is that there's a superficial value and then there's value. And you know, and there's that idea I spoke about a fair bit before the intro was that value is a trade-off. You need to, you know, they talk about Warren Buffett as being a value investor and look at what his great returns. Warren Buffett is not just a value investor. It's all about margin of safety for him. It's about saying he has a certain quality threshold or growth threshold or whatever he's looking for. And then value is a major, major part of making a decision, which we completely agree with. But value on its own is not a is not something you should just you should be looking at.
Blindly adhere to.
Yeah, that's right. And I have an autistic son who's relatively destructive, and I think that shapes in terms of how I look at value in terms of when we're buying stuff. is that, you know, I say, well, if which I think sort of comes back to stocks in a way, is that, you know, if I buy something really expensive, he's just going to wreck it.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But if I buy something really cheap, you know, let's say we're talking about couches. You know, if I bought a $20,000 couch, he's just going to do stuff to it and wreck it, and that's, you know, it's a waste of money.
Yeah, sure.
If I buy a $200 couch from Freedom Furniture or, you know, whatever, he's going to wreck that really quick. Like that's going to last. That's going to last like 20 minutes before I'm replacing that couch. So I'm looking for a quality value trade off. I want to, have, you know, I don't want to pay too much for it. But I need enough quality that he's not going to be able to wreck it quickly.
Yeah.
And so, and I think that's the sort of, you know, that's the idea with this whole value part is that you can't just go buy the cheapest thing out there because sometimes the quality is just not enough, and you're just buying crap.
Yeah.
You're just going to have to throw out. But you know, sure. Getting that middle band of there's enough quality that I can, and at a reasonable price.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good.
Growth has also had a cracking 10 years. The issue with growth.
Just a quick one on that one, though. If you did a growth X FANG stocks, have you had a look at
something like that? I think I've removed a lot of this.
Yeah, I read something. It was just, you know, honestly, the FANG stocks gave about 80% of the push on the in the growth sort of side. You know,
essentially,
if you're picking companies not on like market cap or something like that, and you just had a bit of a look at, you know, some good quality growth companies that, you know, sounded better than the FANG stocks, you're behind from day one. From the sound.
Actually, it's interesting. There's some equal weighted ones that. I don't know if I can test that theory. Anyway, I won't do that. That's probably for one for another. But there's the issue with the issue with growth is over the longer term, and certainly in historical periods, what you've tended to find is that people overpay for it. So they'll find stocks that are growing strongly, and they'll just pay way too much money for those stocks. And those and so it's not that the stocks. There's one issue of when the stocks do go X growth, you need to be careful with that as well. Sure. But the other one is that if you're paying, you know, you're basically saying, okay, I will pay any price at all for Tesla because I believe in the story and I love the cars and all that type of stuff. So regardless of whether it's $100, $1,000 or $10,000 a share, I will still pay it because I love Tesla and I want growth. And that's the part where I'm like going, well, no, you need that. You need that other side of it. And so, and if you certainly look at for the first few months of this year, if you looked at negative earning companies that were losing money, so these growth stocks are priced just on very much on the future, is that their performance was not very good at all. The last month has been pretty good for those ones.
Okay.
But they're the ones that if you're expecting a inflation to keep falling, then they're your sort of good performers. The thing to remember, though, with this growth index, this MSCI one, is that so they use 70% of their measure is they've only got three measures. One is sales growth, the other one's earnings growth, and the other one is what's called analyst long-term growth, which is a number that analysts upload to data providers.
Sure.
And my experience, like I also worked for a number of brokers in earlier years and in all these quantitative areas where we're looking at analysts sort of uploading their data into systems like that MSCI use, an analyst couldn't care less about that long-term growth number. That was the least important number they ever uploaded. Most of them, you know, a lot of the times they'd be just like, oh, well, take these numbers from my model or take whatever I put in my discounted cash flow for that and throw it in or something like there's no basis to, one guy thinks that there's going to be 5% inflation. You know, he thinks it's hyperinflation. He thinks there's 5% inflation. So he's plugged that in. And somebody else thinks it's headed for deflation. So he's got a completely different number that he's uploading. Like there's no sort of balance or anything like that. So I sort of look upon, and some people use those, a lot of analysts will use that as a marketing tool. It's like, oh, yeah, I expect this thing to grow at, 10% per annum for the next 20 years. So it's a marketing tool as opposed to whether they would really believe that that's what,
Who knows as well, though, isn't that the thing? It's like, it's the most subjective component of the whole thing because you know, what can you really do? But draw a line and then just angle the angle of where it's going to go. Is it going to hockey stick or put it? Just a quick one that jumped out at me before, though, as well, actually, just on this growth piece. So you mentioned before, so at some point a growth company stops becoming a growth company, right? Because it's met its
matures
expectation. Yeah. So, you know, and the problem's always that you're sort of paying for future revenue and then, you know, hoping that it will get there. So does that mean that ultimately a good growth company will then become a quality company? Does it mature into being a quality company? Is that the end point?
Ideally. I mean, a lot of it's about the return on investment for quality companies.
Okay.
So if you're seeing companies that are investing a dollar and then getting that dollar back over 2 or 3 years and then plowing that money back in and getting those returns, then they'll end up being your quality companies. The ones you have to watch out for are the ones that are going, okay, I've just invested, you know, my sales are $10 and I've just invested $10. And I've doubled my sales, but my earnings actually haven't gone anywhere because I've doubled my costs as well. And they sort of like this great, or my earnings per share haven't gone anywhere because I'm adding all this extra, shares to it and to sort of fund this growth.
Sure.
It's the question of those ones where is it growth for growth's sake, or growth for more managers' sake that managers, you know, for a CEO, you know, if you're a manager of a company with $1 billion of sales or you're a manager of a company with $5 billion worth of sales, you might be able to justify a significantly higher salary.
That's right.
But for your investors, going from $1 billion of sales to $5 billion might actually be earnings negative. So quality companies you'll see more in that are actually getting a decent return on what they're spending. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Very good. Is that a roll into quality or just
roll into quality? So quality's been a good performer as well. That's also been very much biased towards the FANG stocks. So the big issue with these is that you've had stocks that are converted from being we've got service companies and internet companies tend to show up quite well on quality measures, and so it's structurally been buying those stocks. And the question is, you just want to make sure. Look, I quite like the quality measures, but you just want to make sure that you're actually buying the stocks you think you're buying, and for the right reason. So I've got a slide up showing a stock. So one of the measures they use, I've got a stock showing IBM. So one of the measures that the MSCI quality uses is return on equity, and which is basically what's your profit divided by what's your book value. How much is it? And so they've got this, and so IBM went throughout the 2000s, they went from sort of 20% return on equity, which is still a cracking return, up to 100% return on equity. And you're sort of like, which sounds like unbelievable. Well, it sounds unbelievable because it is unbelievable. like nobody believed that in 2015, that for every dollar that IBM was investing, it was getting back another dollar the next day, you know. That's what 100% return on investment means, is that, you know, you invest another, so you've got a company that's earning
$100. Sounds wonderful.
And so, the reason why, though, is because it's this account, some of these accounting issues, and they were buying back stock and they were converting from being a manufacturer to a service company.
Yep.
And so, and then you see the next few years where their return on equity then fell quite dramatically over the next few years. But, you know, it was this idea that, this return on equity measure, the same problem that you've got with your value indices is also affecting your quality indices.
Right.
So it hasn't actually shown up in terms of the performance because it's been biased about buying tech stocks at the moment and service companies. So, but to pretend that this return on it, that 100% return on equity for IBM means anything, is I think very, very naive.
Yeah,
to say,
sure. Yep.
You know, maybe it is earning a great return, but these numbers, you shouldn't be relying on these numbers. The other thing is, I've got the text there just explaining how the MSCI Quality Index gets measured. It's a I'll read it out. It's a combined Z scores of three Windsorized fundamental variables, namely return on equity, debt to equity, and earnings variability, which sounds nice and techie and important. Windsorizing is basically just saying, well, if there's any data that I don't like, I'll just throw it away.
Right.
It's basically any outliers are gone.
Yep.
So we won't worry about that. And even though a lot of these outliers, things like IBM, where it's showing up going, okay, 100% return on equity is an outlier, is, well, does that actually mean there's something wrong with the model? And they go, no, doesn't. We're just going to, we'll pretend it was 50 instead, because that's like where the 95th percentile was. And so let's just pretend it was, it was a different number. The other thing is they've got this earnings variability, which is a great one. Like, we look at earnings variability as well,
mm-hmm.
as a measure in terms of how they're doing. The only thing is they're running a standard deviation on the earnings growth,
okay.
Which again sounds, I've used those stats. The big issue for me is they're using four data points.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And anyone who's done any statistics would know that four data points is not a lot of
lot
of data.
Yeah,
your confidence in anything using four data points and a standard deviation should be pretty low.
Exactly. Yeah.
So all I'm saying is the quality index. I absolutely believe in buying quality companies, and I think there's a huge benefit to it. But I think the MSCI Quality Index has
work.
Yeah, it has a few fundamental issues in terms of how it's constructed, and so that just means it's got a particular bias that you need to be aware of if you're buying quality stocks that are only going to the MSCI, or if you're following quality managers who are benchmarking themselves against, they're trying to beat that MSCI index.
Yeah.
So they'll have to sort of follow the same path.
Okay. Yeah. Good stuff. All right.
Okay, so then I just wanted to sort of, that's basically it. I know we've probably already gone a little bit over time, but I'll show our quality value graph. So this is how we put together stocks.
Yep.
Is it's all about saying we want to find, we want to put on one axis, the top, the vertical axis, we put the quality. And so from poorest quality at the top to the best quality at the bottom, and then cheap to expensive. And the idea is it's a trade-off. We want to be trying to buy stuff that's under the curve. But the reality is a lot of stuff under the curve is there for the wrong reason. So you need to, there's distortions with its earnings or there's, effects, short-term effects that are making it look like it's there. So you might have a biotech stock or a pharmaceutical stock that sits there because it's got some patents that are expiring in 3 years' time or 4 years' time. And so all the numbers, all the short-term numbers and everything look great, but everyone knows it's finishing up, or it's a mine that's finished. It's a big miner that's got a major mine that's about to run out of ore. And there's those types of things where you might sometimes see stocks that look like they're good quality and good value, but you need to take into account the future. You need to do some fundamental overload.
Sure.
So that's how we're doing it. The outlook, though, which is probably what's most important, I guess, So we've had this bounce back and forth. I mean, it all comes down to, for me, it all comes down to two big factors.
Mm-hmm.
One is what your view is on inflation. Now, our view is that it's transient, it's going to be passing. And so what that means is for us, the rest of the year is going to look more like the latest month
right.
that you've seen,
yep.
more like June and April is more like what market's going to look like. If you think that inflation is here and it's going to make a revival and it's unstoppable and we're off to rate rises and all that type of stuff, then May and February are the strategies you want to be following, and there's the ones that did well in those periods. So you really want to be into your value stocks. Maybe there's a bit of a minimum volatility as well within that, but there's a the idea is that it's that's your big factor. Your second factor is growth. So there's a couple of issues that might cause a fall off in growth over the next 6 months.
Yep.
One of them is China has very much stamped on the debt brakes,
mm-hmm.
and so working out how China goes and where that where we see the slowdown within China is very important when that tails off. And then the other part is within the US,
Although there are infrastructure, there's going to be infrastructure stimulus coming out. There is a gap between when that will actually take hold. The great thing with the checks that they sent out to everyone was the Senate or the House could pass a resolution to send out a bunch of money to ordinary people.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks later, those checks were in the mail.
A couple of weeks later, Bitcoin was at all-time highs.
Exactly. A couple of days later, people are cashing those checks and buying whatever they can. Like that's quick. It gets out there really quickly.
Sure.
And infrastructure. So you send out $1 billion of that. It's in the economy. A month later. You decide to spend an extra $1 billion on infrastructure. Well, you're not doing anything for a while. You're 6 to 12, maybe 18 months away from really spending a lot of that money. There'll be a little bit of it you'll be spending up front, which is like, okay, let's go and do these. Let's go do the surveys. Let's do a little bit of the pre-engineering. Let's start liaising with people about what we're going to have to buy, knock down, who's got complaints, all that type of stuff like environmental impact studies and those things, which is a bit of money, but it's nothing compared to what the actual spending once you start the project.
Yep.
And so,
But part of that as well, though, is when you know that it's coming, I guess it's got that confidence building sort of piece in there, doesn't it? Like if someone says, okay, yep, I'm going to spend $1 billion over the next 18 months, but you're not going to get it all at once. It's still positive. Net positive, isn't it, for companies that are involved in the, receiving some of that along the way?
Yeah. So our base assumption is that there is enough momentum and the reopening, there's enough momentum in that economy that that the growth won't emerge.
Mm-hmm.
But the growth is a very real risk to our, and it's not a tail risk. It's not sort of a 5 or 10% chance that this could derail thing.
Sure.
It's a 30 or 40% probability it could derail things. So you need to be very cognizant of it.
Yep.
And if it does derail things, then you really want to find the it'll be a mixture of quality and some of the more defensive stocks. So some of your low volatility, they're your sort of stocks where that'll perform better in that environment. So so for us, we're sort of going for a mixture of sort of quality and growth metrics with a view that. And a bit of defensiveness, so we're really sort of trying to barbell it.
Yep.
Got enough growth in there that we'll sort of solve the problems. It'll keep us going up if the market's going up. Enough defensiveness if there's a sudden reversal that we won't be left hanging out to dry.
Yep.
And then the question is as if how we tilt either way. So if it looks like the growth is we will sail through that sort of growth slowdown and things will be fine, then we'll just be increasing that quality and that growth within the portfolio.
Sure.
If the more we get concerned, the more we'll be sort of tilting back to some of those defensives within the portfolio. But for us, it's not about the value side, because that was very much an inflation scare.
Mm-hmm.
And that the value side will come back in but it's probably 18 months to 2 years away before we'll be thinking about what we're doing on the value side again.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Now look, terrific run through, and I'm sure there was plenty there for people to take away, Damien. It's great having you on. I think we have just gone a touch over time, so we better wind that one up. But thanks for sharing those thoughts, and it's always good to see how those are reflected in our portfolios, and in particular, of course, the old quality and value chart, which is available to all of our investors in their client dashboards as well for every stock in the portfolio. So thanks again for your time, mate.
Yep, no problems.
Good to have you on. Wonderful. We'll roll across to our viewer question of the week, which is, which investment strategy or style do you think is performing best or is going to perform best, is probably a better way to put it. So we look forward to getting some feedback there, and feel free to drop in your questions in the live stream chat or indeed the video chat as well. Coming up next week, of course, we have our own chief economist, Leith Van Onselen, who's coming along to give us an update on Australian property with his quarterly Australian housing report. As those who have been following the show for a while know, it's always a fascinating review. There's plenty to talk about in this low interest rate world. So tune in next week, Thursday, the 8th of July, 12:30 p.m. for what promises to be a big show on one of Australia's favourite asset classes. Thanks again to all of those who've watched in live for another great episode, and for those who've popped in some comments along the way as well. I hope you've taken away some great ideas, and if you haven't already, feel free to click like on the video to give us some feedback. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com /content. And to stay up to date on news from us, follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who get something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. So thanks again for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and the team. And we look forward to catching you with the next one. Cheers.